Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Plains on the Prairie podcast. I'm Max.
And I'm Sam.
And today we are kicking off our first episode of our Minnesota Aces series. This is something that we've been working on over the summer, and we're really excited to come out with the first video. It's kind of a special topic because not only is it our first Minnesota Ace, it's actually covering the first American Ace of World War II.
Yeah, and funny enough, the ace was not in the U.S. Army Air Force.
Right, so. Yeah. So we're going to talk a little bit about William R. Dunn and his, quite frankly, really interesting career, both with the Royal Air Force and then later on with the U.S. Army Air Force and then with the Chinese.
Yeah, so this guy kind of all over the place. I mean, he literally couldn't get enough, it seems like. So yeah, this is again, the first episode of our series. This is a much larger series in the North Dakota ACES series, just based off of Minnesota's population.
Right.
And I will say the diversity is there, too, just as much as North Dakota.
Yeah, we have, looking forward, we have a lot of exciting pilots and airplanes to cover, including some that I didn't even realize we had Minnesota ACES flying those planes, especially, like, pilots, but ACES in those planes. That's... Yeah, there's one that we're going to come out with around Halloween that I am really excited for. So, we're just looking forward to it.
Right. Yeah, so we'll just jump right into it. So,
let's do it.
Dunn was born on November 16th, 1916, in Minneapolis, Minnesota. He actually spent a lot of time in western North Dakota growing up, so he could be considered a North Dakota ace in his own way. so a good bridge here. So he spent a lot of time with his grandfather out there ranching as a teenager, did a lot of horse riding. Mm-hmm. And also in his teen years, he did learn how to fly. His stepfather was a pilot down in Texas and owned a couple airplanes, and he got hours that way and got his license. Getting a license back then was a little easier. You could just get signed off by an instructor. There really wasn't any FAA back then, so. Then he enlisted in the Army at Fort Lincoln in North Dakota, just outside of Bismarck, actually, in 1934, and was discharged in 35. He didn't really enjoy his time there. He was just looking to get some experience.
Yeah.
And then when war broke out in Europe in 1939, he enlisted in the Canadian Army of the 3rd Brigade of the 1st Infantry Division. Just in September there, right after war broke out in Poland, and actually served all the way up to sergeant major as a rank because of his past U.S. Army experience.
And we have to start his career with shooting down German planes
exactly
pretty early. So I believe he was in France mm-hmm. with the British Expeditionary Force, and the book that we're going to be referencing quite a lot throughout this episode is titled Fighter Pilot, the First American Ace of World War II, by William R. Dunn, published by the University Press of Kentucky in the early 1990s. But it says that while he was at Dunkirk or in France, I don't remember which location, I think he said that a German bomb landed right in a Canadian or British gun emplacement, I believe with the Lewis gun, and killed the crew.
Yes.
But he sprang into action and manned the Lewis gun and actually shot down 2 Stukas from the ground, from a fixed gun position. So, he got some experience early on with down German planes. But, no, very, I think that's got to be the only ace we're going to cover this entire series that probably has a ground kill.
Yeah, like, unless we'll probably find something
maybe,
out. But so far, yeah.
After the retreat from Dunkirk, it was pretty obvious that the RAF was desperately short on pilots. So, fitting with Dunn's personality, the Royal Air Force was looking for even Army members with over 500 hours of flying time. Now, Dunn didn't quite have 500 hours, but with his personality, he says, quote, "I didn't have 500 hours. I had about 130 or 150. But somehow the pencil slipped a little and my figure 1 looked like a 5, end quote. So, he kind of talks like that throughout the book often.
Yeah, there's some interesting comments there that aren't really PC anymore.
Right, and, he makes light of, some pretty, what I would consider, traumatic incidents mm-hmm. that happened to him that we'll talk about later on in the podcast. But the Royal Air Force probably couldn't read very well, or probably just didn't care and took him
in.
They
probably didn't care. They were taking pilots with, you know, 10 hours in Spitfires and throwing them into combat. Right. And that's not an easy airplane to fly. Mm-mm. So it's probably would have ended up getting in anyways, but I think that was funny of him to kind of let that slide. I mean, a lot of people, you know, in the war lied about their age, lied about their experience just to be able to help.
Get into the fight.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So, let's see. He was accepted by the Royal Air Force in December of 1940 and went to flying school at RAF Turnhill and graduated, in April of 1941 with the rank of pilot officer. Now, as an American, he wasn't assigned to one of the British squadrons that was defending England at that time. He would have been assigned to the very famous number 71 Eagle Squadron. Now, for the longtime listeners of the podcast, you might know one of our North Dakotan aces also served with that squadron. North Dakota ace Oscar Cohen was also a member of number 71 Squadron and was actually mentioned at least once, maybe twice in the book.
Yeah, and it actually mentioned him being kind of a prankster, Oscar Cohen. It would have been cool to find that out, you know.
Right, and I know, obviously, the British are known for their pubs and all that, so I think that at least the first time he's mentioned is one of his antics at a local pub there, which is pretty funny. So from May to August of 1941, Dunn served with number 71 Squadron and shot down 5.5 German fighters. Now, the first kill came on July 2nd and was a BF-109. Now, what made this kill impressive is that it was actually apparently recorded as the first enemy aircraft shot down by the Eagle Squadron. So, pretty cool that the first plane was scored by the first ace. So, you know,
it fits.
There's so many different things that we could talk about that with that kill, but the second one came just 4 days later on July 6th when it was a shared kill, again, on another BF-109. Unfortunately, we do not know the other pilot that was credited with the other half of the kill. Third came on July 21st against a BF-109. And then the fourth one came on August 9th. Again, these are all BF-109s. Fourth one came on August 9th. And then he scored two BF-109 kills on the August 27th. So pretty busy month and a little bit month and a half for Dunn and Eagle Squadron. Would that have been at the height of the Blitz, or probably maybe not?
It would
not
have been just kind of during the Blitz.
Yeah.
I mean, German air power was still at its biggest in 1941. You know, you had the modern airplanes. You had the BF-109Fs coming out, and FW-190s were starting to make their scene in later of 1941. And then the Germans were also getting a little preoccupied over in the east in summer. So there probably could have been a diversion of forces too. But yeah, during this August 27th encounter, came a little bit at a cost. Mm-hmm. So he actually got shot up pretty good in this. He ended up making it on the ground and was wounded. He actually ended up having to convalesce for 3 months in a hospital and actually lost part of his right foot.
Yes. He mentions in the book that I think it was a cannon shell that went right through, you know, the forward section of his Spitfire's cockpit and, blew off a good chunk of his right foot. And, I can't imagine that would be a very enjoyable experience.
He talked quite a bit about his experience in the hospital there and some of the lessons he learned. He was, lack of better terms, he was complaining a lot in the hospital, if you remember reading about that. But then he had a guy about his meal. He didn't get a meal ticket. And then the guy who was next to him gave him his, and he ended up dying that night. And
Wasn't he super burned?
He was, and it kind of shed some light on the humanity of war. Because when we talk about aces, it's all the glamour. It's all the shoot downs. Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, it's not all that, but the front part of it is kind of about the accomplishments, but then Dunn does a really great job of showing, okay, this is real.
I couldn't put it better myself. This is real. Like, you know, people are dying, people are getting hurt, and it's war.
Yes.
There's nothing glorifying about that. So after he was released from the hospital, he was not immediately returned to combat. In fact, he was actually sent to Canada to serve as an instructor with the Royal Canadian Air Force. And around that time, the you know, the United States had gotten involved after the attack on Pearl Harbor. Mm-hmm. The U.S. Army Air Force was ramping up and looking for, obviously, pilots. And around that time, number 71 Eagle Squadron was released from American, or excuse me, from British control and given to the Americans. So at that time, in June of 1943, Dunn was transferred to the U.S. Army Air Force and commissioned as a first lieutenant. I think in the book, was that kind of a downgrade for him, or was that about equal?
It was about equal. Okay. He just wanted he wanted a higher rank than that. Mm-hmm. But as you can see, it took some time. I mean, there was a lot of processing. I mean, Eagle Squadron was around longer than Pearl Harbor, of course. Later became the 4th Fighter Group. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But
I learned from that, or I learned about that from the greatest World War II movie ever, Pearl Harbor.
Yeah. Yeah, so good movie.
Yeah. So after being commissioned as a first lieutenant in the U.S. Army Air Force, Dunn was assigned to the 513th Fighter Squadron, 406th Fighter Group, flying P-47s, and he achieved his 6th and final victory of the war in June of 1944 against a BF-110.
Little diversity.
Little diversity. Not all BF-109, the early models, but had to get a BF-110 in there as well.
Yeah.
So after he was promoted subsequently to captain and then major, Dunn was promoted to lieutenant colonel and was transferred, of all places, to the China-Burma-India Theater to command, Luchian and Lukau air bases from May of 1945 through the end of the war into 1947. So, didn't score any kills while in the Pacific. That would have been incredible, but again, a very impressive career and wartime experience for William R. Dunn. In 1947, Dunn was sent to serve as an advisor for, of all people, the Chinese Nationalist Air Force during the Chinese Civil War. In particular, he was assigned to the 4th Fighter Group of the Chinese Nationalist Air Force, who were equipped with surplus P-51D Mustangs.
He even actually flew on combat missions. Yes, yeah, yes, so that was interesting. And that air base command didn't really have a flying position, so he was really itching to get back into it. So this,
and as the commander, mm-hmm. it's like, hey, I make the rules around here. I'm doing it if I want to.
Yeah.
And then again, the guy's story just keeps on getting more incredible. He served as an advisor to the Imperial Iranian Air Force from 1947 through 1949. And he resigned his commission in 1949 and joined the enlisted side of the U.S. Army. No, excuse me, the U.S. Air Force as a master sergeant. So, kind of an interesting career move. Yeah. I don't know if a lot of people would do the same, but I can't remember. Maybe you recall. Was there any particular reason why he did that?
It seemed like he didn't want like the big command stuff. Mm-hmm. He just wanted to do his time, and it was kind of an interesting move that. Makes me scratch my head.
Yeah.
Just because, back then, especially officers were just way on a higher pedestal. They treated way better. The pay was way better. But probably just something about serving.
Yeah, absolutely. He had while as a enlisted side, he achieved the rank of warrant officer and chief warrant officer in the 1950s. And not to be outdone, also served as an advisor to the Brazilian Air Force in South America. Now, back in U.S. Army, or I keep saying that, back in U.S. Air Force careers, he served at various bases throughout the 1950s and early 1960s, and to wrap up his military service, was actually stationed in Vietnam at Tansanut Air Base from 1967 until 1968, and talks a little bit about his experiences during the Tet Offensive in early 1968. I believe he mentions that obviously the bombs were falling, mm-hmm. kind of chaos at the main gate to the base. One of my dad's uncles was also in Vietnam during the Tet Offensive, and what he was saying about Tet, it lined up exactly to the stories that I've heard about it. Yeah. So just chaos. Had no idea what was coming, and obviously that left a lasting impression on Dunn. And he retired from the U.S. Air Force at the rank of lieutenant colonel in 1973.
And I thought that was interesting. He's got his commission back for the retirement.
Right.
Not just at the end. So he kind of got promoted quite a bit right there. So.
Yep. So after retirement, Dunn, I don't think...
He kind of had a quiet retirement, is what it seemed like.
Yeah, I honestly, I'm racking my brain. I don't recall what.
Yeah, there wasn't much in the book, anyways, right. In the way of retirement.
But William R. Dunn passed away on February 14th, 1995. Just again, incredible life.
Exactly.
Very fascinating. We should mention that it wasn't confirmed that he was the first American ace until a review board in the 1960s re-examined the dates of the kills and came to the conclusion that Dunn was actually the first.
Yeah.
So, again, the first American ace of World War II. It took a little bit of time, but Minnesotan.
There you go.
That is awesome.
Yeah, so now we'll transition over to this, the units. We're going to follow the same template as what we had for the right. The North Dakota side. So we'll be covering all three of the units that he was majorly attached to in his career, including number 71 Squadron, 513th Fighter Squadron, the 4th Fighter Group. So we'll start right off with the 71 Eagle Squadron. That squadron was formed in September 1940 at RAF Church Fenton. And it was comprised of, you know, all American pilots, was originally attached with British Command. And it was the first of the three Eagle squadrons and originally was equipped with Brewster Buffaloes for a very short time. They were quickly replaced by the Hurricane Mark I's due to the Buffaloes' problems at altitude and just unsuitability for the theater. It wasn't the most maneuverable it was, but just didn't suit, and all of those Buffaloes then right. subsequently got sent over to Singapore and Malaya.
Well, they achieved much more success.
No.
Right? No, they didn't? Okay.
No.
They were just terrible.
Yeah, that's something I've been kind of slowly researching is early Pacific War on the British
yes,
side of things.
You have. Oh my
and
goodness.
Yeah, they unfortunately, attrition got them too.
Gotcha.
If you're interested, feel free to message us. I have about three or four different titles on Brewster Buffaloes in Singapore.
That you're reading just right now.
yeah, kind of here and there. They're very dense. and then they became officially operational in February 1941 after they were equipped with the Hurricanes at RAF Curtin in Lindsay and moved to actually RAF Martlesham Heath in April 1941. And then later in August, you know, after Dunn started flying,
right.
you know, he actually got a couple of his kills in the Hurricanes and was then transferred over to Spitfire Mark IIs in August, Mark IIAs specifically. And then after Pearl Harbor, many Eagle Squadron pilots chose to transfer over to the U.S. Army Air Force under the 4th Fighter Group, which Cohen was an ace of. And, you know, there's many other famous aces.
Oh, yeah.
So we got Don Emerson from our Christmas special.
Yeah. Not and quite an ace, but, you know, still, but North Dakota.
Other pilots,
roots.
Yep.
Absolutely.
So, but yeah, Eagle Squadron kind of has a lasting impression. They're, you know, we talked about if you want to see anything with Eagle Squadron, there's a couple movies out there. A great one called Pearl Harbor. Super accurate.
Very accurate.
Talks a little bit about it, but it does shed a good light.
It does.
I agree.
So, although Dunn was a member of the Eagle Squadron, he did not actually transfer to the 4th Fighter Group. Kind of interesting. I can't imagine a lot of pilots did that. So instead, Dunn was transferred to the 513th Fighter Squadron of the 406th Fighter Group. So the 513th was established in March 1943 as a dive bomber unit at Key Field in Mississippi, which is now today home of the Mississippi Air National Guard, I believe flying KC-135s. Excuse me. In March 1944, the unit was redesignated as a fighter bomber group and equipped with P-47 Thunderbolts, and was slated for combat in the European theater. The group provided air cover during the Normandy landings in June of 1944, and then really got their hands dirty with air interdiction missions against German ground targets, trucks, troop concentrations. You know, we all seen the footage.
Mm-hmm.
We know that the air power of the Allies quickly dominated the Normandy ground battle landscape. You know, you hear about, like, the trucks and tanks and troops having to literally be moved at night in the complete darkness just to avoid the slaughter. After the war ended in 1945, the group stayed in Europe and was inactivated in 1946. However, with the Cold War obviously ramping up following World War II, they were reactivated in 1952 as the 406 Fighter Bomber Group, and equipped with F-84Gs, then F-86Fs, and then followed by F-86D Sabre Dogs around 1955-56 before being inactivated for the final time in 1956, which they remain today.
Yep. Cool. And then one thing I did find actually on the 406 fighter group as a whole, before they were equipped with P-47s, they were kind of a composite group. They kind of had like A-20s, A-24 Banshees, cool. The Army version of the Dauntless, and kind of an interesting, didn't find much, but I thought that was kind of interesting.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and then we'll talk about his final major unit he was attached to and on the flying side. So we have the 4th Fighter Group of the Chinese Nationalist Air Force. This was the one he served as an advisor for. They were established in 1936 in Hangzhou and was initially equipped with Polikarpov I-15s and I-16s, relics of the Soviet Union. And actually around then they were still considered modern aircraft. You know, that was the early days when Chenault was an advisor.
Right.
And then they actually later moved to India due to the Japanese invasion and was equipped with first Curtiss P-40s and Republic P-43 Lancers in 1942 until 44. And the Lancers actually served quite a bit, and attrition kind of got them because the U.S., it didn't fit the U.S.'s mold for a fighter.
Right.
The Lancer actually is the predecessor to the 47.
I was going to say, actually, I don't know. That's kind of one of those planes that's really forgotten about.
Yeah, basically picture a P-47. This is really simplified, okay? So it's kind of a mold between a P-35, a Sikorsky P-35, and a P-47. Wings are similar on the P-47. The fuselage more looks like a Razorback D model.
Yeah, I think I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. Very maneuverable, actually. Hmm. A good turning characteristics.
You need it against the Japanese.
Yeah, they're very light and unarmored, so that helped.
Sounds like a hero.
Later in the war, they were actually equipped with P-51 Mustangs somewhere in 44, 45, and were actually used during the Chinese Civil War. And later on, they were actually captured by the communists and used for a while. But then later on, after the move to Taiwan, they were reorganized into the 4th Fighter Wing and is currently equipped with F-16s flying today.
Wow.
And they have a really good write-up on their website
for the 4th Fighter Wing. Their website was very impressive.
And, yeah, it's well translated and everything.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
Well, that is all the units that at least we could find by number that Dunn served with. Now we come to the end of our podcast where we talk about surviving aircraft. Now, we were talking before the episode that probably not a good chance that one of Dunn Spitfire or Hurricane would survive an airworthy condition, just considering how the Brits are with their Spitfires and all their homegrown aircraft. I feel like they would be very not inclined to have an American's aircraft painted up on one of their airworthy Spitfires. But if you are interested, if you can make your way down to Seymour Johnson Air Force Base in North Carolina, the home of the modern-day 4th Fighter Wing, they actually have a 1-to-1 scale replica of Dunn's Spitfire on display, I believe, right outside of the Visitor Center. We're looking at a picture of it right here, and it looks, at least in this picture, it looks
good.
Looks great, absolutely. His Spitfire was marked XRD, and if I remember correctly, his the British had a very interesting way of denoting aircraft, you know. Army Air Force and U.S. Air Force serials are usually the last two digits of the fiscal year that it was ordered, followed by whatever number of aircraft it was ordered that year. The British, on the other hand, had different letter designations for each aircraft. The Spitfire, at least early on in the war, was P. So his aircraft was P-7308. And I believe that's the one that he scored a few of his kills in. The cover of the book also features, that same aircraft, maybe a little bit artistic license with the BF-109s going down. But very, very cool aircraft. And the fact that it survives in the United States, let alone at an Army Air Force, or I keep saying that, at an Air Force base, is very impressive. So I'm hoping that sometime in the future I can make it out. I actually used to live in North Carolina, so I'm hoping I can make it out there and get access to Seymour Johnson Air Force Base to see this aircraft and a few other statics on display. But with that, that really kind of concludes our first episode.
Yeah, so we're really happy to be back into this. It's been, 10 or 11 months since we've finished the North Dakota series.
Yeah.
So it's really exciting to get this back to you guys. Our schedules are getting a lot better now as fall's kind of in full swing.
Absolutely.
You know, it's going to be exciting to kind of start pumping these out, hopefully weekly. We can't 100% promise that, but we're going to do our best to put them out every week.
Absolutely. Well, Sam, do you have anything else to add?
No, this was a lot of fun.
Absolutely. Well, we'll see you guys next week. And again, thanks for tuning in, and we'll catch you on the next one.
All right. Thanks, guys.